What?
Okay, so I hope all of you had a good spring break. So I'm going to do a recap of the material just before spring break. Be sure to switch off laptops. Think that you're on a plane taking off and cell phone. So just to recap, because the attendance had dropped dramatically before spring break. Looks like people took off early or didn't feel that they had the energy to come after the exam. So I just want to do a recap of the material, so we will so we can actually start from that point. So we were talking about memory management, if you remember. So we have actually done three lectures on memory management already. Okay, the first one was contiguous memory allocation. In this view of memory, you basically have RAM and you are allocating memory to processes in contiguous chunks. Okay, the process comes in, it requests certain amount of RAM, you allocate a chunk, and when the process finishes, you deallocate that chunk. Okay, over time, as processes come and go, memory gets fragmented. Okay, because whenever you deallocate, there is this free memory which is called holes that is created, and holes get fragmented over time. You have lots of little pieces, so you get external fragmentation. Okay, so the main issue with this contiguous allocation is you have to deal with external fragmentation, which we will handle using compaction. Okay, now this at least this you need to understand very well, because the lab that I'm going to discuss today, okay, deals directly with contiguous memory allocation. Okay, that was the first lecture on memory management. The second lecture started talking about paging. Okay, so basically we said one way to eliminate fragmentation is to allocate memory in fixed size chunks. What contiguous memory allocation does is it allocates memory in variable size chunks. Okay, that's how you get into fragmentation. But if you have small chunks of memory, okay, fixed size chunks, 4K or 8K of RAM, that you allocate to processes, then you can get rid of external fragmentation. So in this view, each process is chopped up into chunks of memory called pages of fixed size, and RAM is also chopped up into chunks of memory called frames. Okay? And pages are allocated to frames. We relax the assumption of contiguous memory allocation. Okay? Any page can be resident anywhere in RAM, okay? Which means that the process is not contiguously laid out. Okay. So to deal with this, you need additional data structure. The key one is the page table. Okay. Page table maps pages from two frames. Okay. And that by eliminating variable size allocation, we have gotten rid of the problem of external fragmentation. So the second lecture, okay, on memory management. The last lecture, the Thursday before spring break, we looked at segmentation. Okay. Very few people were here, so I'm going to spend 2 minutes talking about this. So as is mentioned here, segmentation is the user's view of a program. Okay? Any process essentially is said to have many multiple segments of memory. Okay? This is the process layout. So you have the code segment, you may have the stack segment that's growing this way, you may have the heap segment. Okay? These are parts of a process. The code segment contains the code for the process. The stack segment keeps track of the stack of the methods that you call. The heap segment has dynamically allocated memory. Anytime you do new or malloc or something like that, to instantiate a new class or object, you would get memory from the heap. Okay? So this is how the compiler or the user view a process. Okay? So what you have are, so each of this is a segment of variable size. Okay, so you could then use this scheme called segmentation, where you have allocated multiple chunks of memory, each could be a variable size, each of them holds a segment of that process. Okay? And to do this, you need a data structure called the segment table. The segment table essentially maps segment IDs to regions of memory where that segment is stored. Okay? The problem with segmentation, okay, the nice thing about segmentation is that the layout of memory maps to your view of what a process contains. The disadvantage is you have variable size segments. Okay, so allocating memory in variable size chunks brings back the problem of fragmentation. Okay, so to address this, what we said is you can take paging, which is a scheme that eliminated fragmentation, and merge those ideas with segmentation to get this new technique called segmented paging. So what you do here, you still retain this view of a process. Okay, process consists of different segment. Each segment has a particular purpose. Okay, it may contain code or data. Okay, of different type. So what you then do is you chop each segment into pages. Okay, of fixed size, and then pages are mapped. This is RAM. Pages are mapped to frames of memory. Okay, so you basically page each segment and get rid of the problem of external fragmentation again. Okay, so you'll keep both views of memory, the paging view as well as the segmentation view. So this is a complicated scheme because it involves segmentation and paging, and multiple data structures are needed. Okay, there's a segment table which tracks the segment. Okay, for each segment there's a page table. Okay, so the code segment has a page table and a stack segment has a page table and so on. Okay, and the way you will address memory here is you will specify a segment ID, you will specify a page number, and you will specify an offset. So each virtual address actually has three components. The segment that you care about, if your number segment 0, 1, 2, so if you say segment 1, you are referring to the stack segment. And then if you say page number 5, so you are referring to the fifth page in that segment, and then you specify an offset, let's say the 10th byte, okay, and so on. Okay. So I urge you to go back to that lecture notes, okay, that I had put up last time, and understand how you do the translation carefully, okay, because they have to look up a segment table, you have to look up a page table and whatnot. Okay. So it's more complicated, okay, but it's important to understand how you do this. Okay. And then there was this notion of a TLB or a translation look aside buffer. Okay. The basic purpose of the TLB is to speed up memory accesses. Okay, whenever you have a page table or a segment table, okay, these data structures are themselves kept in RAM by the OS kernel. Okay. So to access memory, you have to first look up the data structure, the page table or the segment table, and then find out where the page you care about is resident in memory. This slows down performance. Okay, because each memory reference becomes 2x or 3x slower, okay, depending on whether you have to look up the segment table and the page table or just one of the two. Okay. So to do this, we have a cache called the TLB, which stores frequently accessed entries from these data structures, the page table and the segment table. Okay, and that will help us address the memory slowdown somewhat. Okay, so that in a nutshell is basically a recap of these three classes that we have already gone through. Okay, and I will talk about the next lab assignment today that will deal with contiguous memory allocation. Okay, and then we'll also talk about some new material which is demand-based virtual memory. Okay, so are there any questions on memory management so far? Is everything cashed out of memory? Or people remember some of this discussion? Okay, so do go back, look at the material, okay, because we are actually going to continue from a segmented paging and look at demand paged virtual memory today. Okay. So what is virtual memory? So thus far we have assumed that the address space of a process is completely resident in RAM. Okay. So what that means is the entire process is resident in memory at all times. Okay. We made this assumption with contiguous memory allocation. We made this assumption with paging. We made this assumption with segmentation and segmented paging. Entire process is always in RAM. Okay. So the number of processes you can run is limited by the size of your RAM. Okay. Your 2 gig of memory on your machine, you can only run processes once that fill up this 2 gig, and if 2 gig is all used up, you can't start any new process. That's the assumption we have made so far. Okay, we want to relax that assumption. Okay, so what do we want? We want to provide the illusion of essentially infinite memory. Okay, let the user start as many processes as he or she wants. Okay, and we will not restrict the size of the number of processes based on the amount of RAM you have. Okay, how do we go about relaxing this assumption? Okay, so that's what virtual memory will allow us to do. So what do we do? Okay, if you do not have sufficient RAM, you have to keep these processes somewhere. Okay? So what we will do is we will use another storage medium. In this case, it will be the disk as the backing store for RAM. Anything you cannot fit in RAM, okay, you will actually keep on disk. Okay? And you will only bring stuff from disk into RAM as needed. Okay? This will allow us to have to provide the illusion of essentially infinite RAM. Okay, so disk is essentially is behaving as if it's a very, very slow RAM. I mean, it's orders of magnitude slower, but it can help you address this limitation of not being restricted by the size of your RAM. Okay. So what do we do? So we provide this, or the OS is providing you this notion of essentially infinite memory, which is this technique is going to be referred to as virtual memory. Okay. So what this allows us are all of these things. It allows a process itself, a single process, to be larger than the size of RAM. Okay, you have 2 gig of memory, you can start a process that's 4 gig in size, not a problem. Okay? Because you will only bring or keep pieces of the process in RAM at any given time, the rest of the process is stored on disk. Disk is essentially large, so we don't care. I mean, you can have a terabyte of disk on your desktop these days. Okay? So process itself can be larger than RAM. Okay? Process can execute even if the entire process is not resident in RAM. Only pieces of the process will be in RAM. This we will refer to as the working set of that process. Okay? And then we'll also allow more processes to fit to run than you have RAM. Okay? The total size of all of the processes will be much greater than the size of RAM you have, and this is still okay. Okay? So these are 3 things that virtual memory allows us to do. Okay, so this is adds flexibility to what your OS allows you to do. Yes, question. Does it matter what format you have your disk in? So there are 2 ways to answer that question. So in some operating system, there's a special region of disk which is called swap space. Okay? That region of disk is specially formatted by the OS just to store memory pages. Each block of disk will correspond to a size of a page. Okay, so there's one-to-one mapping. Okay, this allows you to make efficient use of disk. Okay, now that said, there are many operating systems that just create a large file, okay, 1 year file system, and just use that as your virtual memory. Okay, so in Windows, for instance, you have something called a Hibernate file. That's not virtual memory, but that's a file that stores the contents of your RAM. Okay, when you put your laptop to sleep. So you can actually have entire files that also act as swap, but in this case your access to disk will be even slower because you are going through the file system. Okay, so if you want to do the right thing, you will set aside some region of disk, and that region will actually take care of virtual memory. Okay, so that's basically what we want to study. Now let's see how to go about doing all this. Okay, so this, so demand page virtual memory. So virtual memory is essentially this abstraction that allows you to have to pretend as if you have more RAM than you actually have. Demand paging is essentially a technique which says you will only bring stuff into memory as needed. Okay, and we'll see how to go about doing both of this. Okay. So what we will do is we'll assume that RAM is now essentially a cache for disk. Okay. By default, any process that you create will be resident on disk. Okay. And RAM is essentially a cache. You'll only bring parts of that process into RAM as needed. Okay. And the rest of the process will always be resident on disk. As some parts of the processes are brought in, others must be put back on disk. Okay. So these go hand in hand. Okay. So now to do this, we have to extend this page table abstraction. Earlier, the page table was simply a mapping from pages to frames. Okay. In memory. Now the page table has to keep track of which frames are on disk and which frames are in memory. Okay, so page table will not only point to frames, but frames that are not resident in RAM, you will have a pointer to disk, and this is where the frame is. Okay? And if you try to access that frame, then the OS will dynamically bring that frame from disk into RAM. Okay, so that you can actually access it. Okay, so we'll have additional bits into this that we'll put in the page table that tells the OS which pages are in disk, which pages are in RAM, and so on. Okay? Every time you bring a page from disk to RAM, you will update the page table, okay, saying this is the new location of the page. Every time you evict a page from RAM and put it back into disk, you will also update the page table, saying now this page has gone back to disk. And you will use the valid bit to say, is this on disk or RAM? That bit, if the bit is set, it says the page is in RAM. The bit is not set, it says the page is on disk. Okay. And for efficiency reasons, okay, we want a property which says most of your memory accesses have to be hits. Okay. Most of the memory accesses goes to pages on disk, then your system is going to slow down tremendously. Okay. This is simply because disk is significantly slower, several orders of magnitude slower than disk. If you keep accessing pages that are on disk frequently, your program or process will stop, okay, because you have to wait for the OS to load the page. Okay. So you want to reduce accesses to pages on disk as much as possible. Okay. And the reason we can actually do that is because processes exhibit locality of reference. We'll come back to this notion in just a moment. Okay. So essentially, you want to allocate enough RAM to the process so that its working set is actually resident in RAM at any time. Okay. Think of the working set as a loose definition of the working set as the pages that are currently in active use. Okay. These are the pages that contain code that your program is executing, any data that these instructions access. This, at any given time, there is a working set of the process. This is the part of RAM that is in active use, and the rest of the memory of the process is not in active use, that not the working set. Right? So the basic intuition is if you keep the working set in RAM, okay, then most of the work that the process is doing will be hits. You will actually be accessing pages that are already resident in RAM. Okay? Clearly, the working set will change over time. Okay? As the process executes, okay, and it goes to a different part of the program, the working set will change because those instructions might access some other variables. Okay. So as the working set changes, you take the pages from the old working set and you evict them and you bring the pages from the new working set in RAM. Okay. But the changes to the working set are slow and gradual. So long as you have the current working set, you are going to get this property which says most of the memory accesses reference pages that are in memory and not pages that are on disk. Yeah, and we'll come back to this as well. So that's the 90-10 rule which we have looked at before. 90% of the time your process is accessing only 10% of its pages. Okay, those pages are the working set of that process. Okay. So now let's look at some figures and try to understand. So this is the new layout. Okay. Now you have process, part of the process is in RAM, part of the process is in disk. And so these are the pages of a process. Okay. And as you can see, some pages are actually in RAM, that's the arrow here, some pages are only on disk. So the page table is going to keep track. So it will say page 1, okay, that's in RAM, that's stored here. Page 3 is actually in RAM, stored here. This is page 6, that's actually on disk. Okay, so page table has pointers to where the page is stored. If it's in RAM, it has the memory address, okay, of that page. If it's on disk, it has a disk address for that page. Okay. So anytime a process actually accesses the page, you have to look up the page table. Okay. If it's in RAM, you just do the translation like we did before. If it's on disk, then you stall. Okay. You will say, now I need to fetch this page because it's not in RAM. Okay. So you will stall the process, you will fetch the page, okay, put it in RAM, and then you will update the page table and then the process will continue. Okay. This is how execution will work. Okay. So you are fetching pages on demand. Okay, in demand page virtual memory. Only when the process accesses the page for the first time, it's fetched into memory. Okay. So that brings up the question of when should you load the page. Right? So we discussed one option which is on demand, but that's not the only option that's available to the OS. There are many other options. Okay. So all the techniques that we studied until today assume the first thing, okay, which is that you load all of the pages at process start time, okay, because we assume that the process was always resident in RAM. So whenever the process starts up, you allocate some memory, okay, either contiguous chunks or pages. You load all of the code from disk, you set up the RAM for the stack and whatnot, and you are done. Okay, and then from that point on, there is nothing to do. Process may grow or shrink, so but that doesn't mean that you have to deal with loading pages. Okay, so that's number one. Okay, the second technique is overlays. Okay, which allows you to swap an entire process in and out. Okay, we briefly mentioned this when I talked about contiguous allocation. Okay, the way you can use contiguous allocation and yet have more processes run than RAM is to do what are called overlays. Okay, you can take an entire process, swap the whole process out to disk, load a new process, run that process for some time, take that process, swap it out to disk, bring in another process and so on. Okay, this is called overlays, not very efficient, because you are copying lots of RAM back and forth. Okay? But in this technique, you will load the process whenever you want to schedule it for execution. Okay? So these are two techniques that we will not really worry about from a virtual memory standpoint. Okay? Here are things that we do care about. Request paging. Okay? In request paging, a process explicitly tells the OS saying I want to access this page in the near future. So you request the OS and tell the OS to make sure the page is in RAM. Okay? So when time comes to access it, it's already there. Okay? So in this case, the OS is providing, not the OS, the process is providing hints to the OS, telling the OS which pages to keep in RAM and which ones not to keep in RAM. Your typical process is not going to do this. When you write code for your application, you don't write code to tell the OS which pages to fetch and what not. Okay? But this technique is available, okay, in some operating system. If you are writing a process where you want to carefully do your own memory management, okay, rather than the OS doing it for you, you do request paging. It tells you, tell the OS what you want and the OS will fetch it for you. Okay. The technique that we have been talking about today is demand paging. Okay. So demand paging says OS loads the page the first time it's referenced. Okay. Everything is loaded on demand. Okay. So when a process starts up, what do you do? Okay. Which pages do you fetch? So pure demand page scheme. Sorry? No, that's when the OS starts up. I'm saying when the process starts up. If you look at this picture, when a process starts up, you do nothing. Okay? You just allocate some space on swap space or in virtual memory. Pages of the process are actually on disk. You haven't done anything. Okay? So you try to execute the first instruction. Okay? Immediate page fault. Nothing is loaded in memory. So if you even try to access the first instruction, the page is not in memory. Okay? So you take a page fault, you will go fetch the first page of the code segment, okay, into RAM. Okay? So after some time, the page comes into RAM, you update the page table, you try to re-execute that instruction, okay, the first instruction. And at that point, the page is in memory, but it may access some data. Okay? You may say, move this variable into this register. It's another page fault because you just got the code page. You don't have any data in RAM. Okay? You take a second page fault, will bring the data page. Okay? And then maybe after a couple of page faults, you can actually execute that instruction. Okay? So you execute. Then you execute the next instruction. If it accesses another data page that's not in memory, you'll fetch that page and so on. Okay, so any time you start a process, you essentially start with a clean slate. There's nothing in RAM. Okay? As and when you execute instructions, you start taking page faults, and you start fetching pages into RAM. Right? After some number of instructions, few hundred or few thousand instructions, you have fetched sufficient pages in RAM so that the working set of that process at that instant is all in RAM. At this point, the process can run at full speed without taking page faults. Okay? And as the working set keeps changing, you again start seeing page faults. Okay? And then your new working set will be fetched into memory and so on. Okay. So everything is done on demand. The OS doesn't know what pages to fetch, so it just lets the process execute, and as it takes page fault, it just fetches pages for the process. Okay. That's referred to as demand, pure demand paging. Okay, is that clear? As you can see, any time you take a page fault, you will have a performance stall. Okay, because the performance of the process is going to suffer because the process cannot proceed with execution. The pages that it needs are not in RAM. Okay, you have to wait until the OS has fetched them to RAM. Okay. So to optimize the performance of demand paging, some operating systems do pre-paging. Okay. Pre-paging is basically educated guesses on behalf of the OS as to what pages the process might need next. Okay. And it tries to pre-fetch those pages before the page fault has occurred. Okay, in so as to optimize performance. Okay. So for instance, it is a simple guess for the operating system to say when a new process starts up, just pre-page the first few code pages. That's where the process is going to begin. Why wait for the process to fault? Okay. So just when the process starts up, just allocate a few frames and just load those pages and then start executing so you don't have an immediate page fault, which you would have seen in pure demand paging. Okay. If the process is executing some sequential code and then it's actually at the end of the code page, then you know that it will actually start executing instructions in the next code page. So let's prefetch those pages. Yeah, that's what an operating system might do. Okay? If it guesses correctly, then the performance of the process is going to improve because you already fetched the page just in time before you execute instructions or access data from that page. If you guess wrong, then you did wasteful work. Why might you guess wrong? Does process execute sequential code? You have loops in a process, you make function calls, you call arbitrary stuff, so you will have branches in a program. You don't know when a program is executing what branches it's going to take ahead of time. You as in the OS will not know that. Okay. So it can make some guesses, but it will not know for sure. Okay. So sometimes it may make the right choices and sometimes it will not. Okay, yes, question.
What will the prepaid do with a new process? Like if one just starts up, does that have any information?
Right. So for a new process, there is very little you can do. Just load the first few code pages because you start execution somewhere in the first code page. That's about as much as you can do. Some operating systems have looked at multiple executions of the same process. Okay, so if you are, let's say you're doing ls on the command line. Okay, if you actually profile the application and say this is how typical execution of this program works and you keep that history around, next time you start the same application, it could even be a browser for instance. Okay, so if you actually kept history information about what a browser process does typically, let's say Firefox or Safari or IE, you can use that information in the pre-pager. Okay? Typical operating systems will not do that, okay? But you could certainly keep profiles of the application, memory access patterns of the application around. So when you restart this application, you know something about what had happened the previous time. It's not a guarantee that the application will do exactly that, okay? Because what you do with the process is really up to you, the user. But you can make better guesses by keeping history. If you don't have any history, then you cannot do much, okay? Other than to track execution patterns and make some guesses. Is this clear? Any questions on this? Okay, so here is now an implementation of demand paging. Okay. So we said that whenever you start a process, the first thing is you always store an entire copy of the process on disk, okay, in swap space. Okay. And then you create a page table. Initially the page table is empty, okay, rather the page table is all pointing to pages on disk. All the valid bits are reset, saying all the pages are on disk. Okay. So one says it's in memory, zero says it's on disk. Okay. Every time you access and try to access a page, if it's not in memory, you will have what's called a page fault. Okay. Page fault says that you access the page that's not resident in RAM. Okay. So at that point you have to check that the address is valid, and if so, then you have to figure out, you have to bring a page into RAM at this point. Okay. But to do that, you have to figure out what page are you going to evict. Okay. Because the RAM may be full, so you might have to evict a page. So you will first select a page to replace. Okay. This is done by a technique called page replacement that we'll look at shortly. Okay. Then you invalidate that page that you are going to throw out, okay, from the page table. Okay. You start loading the new page from disk. Okay. And while this is happening, your process is blocked. Okay. It's basically doing I/O at this point. Page fault is essentially I/O saying fetch that page from disk. Okay. So it's going to go on to the wait queue. You will context switch and run some other process. That process is stalled. Some other process will run. At some later point in time, your page has arrived into RAM. You sort of fetch the page and you loaded it in RAM. The OS will then update the page table entry and resume execution of the process. Okay? So this is what is going to happen every time you try to access a page and you have a page fault. Okay, so there are some interactions here between scheduling and memory management, as you will see. Every time you have a page fault, you'll basically have to run something else, okay, to keep the CPU busy because this current process is stalled. Any questions on this? So I think I had a picture somewhere. We'll come back to the picture. So now you can ask what happens when you take a page. So I talked about evicting a page here. Right? So this is the process of bringing pages from disk into RAM. Okay? The first step here is taking some pages that are resident in RAM and putting them back on disk. Okay? Because you're making space for a page that's coming in. Okay, I'll show you a picture in just a moment. So then the question is, what do you do with that page? So you have a page in RAM, you want to evict the page. Okay? So it has to free up enough memory to bring in a new page. Okay? Question is, what do you do with that page? Okay, so you can write it back to disk. There are two things you can do. Just overwrite that page or write it back to disk. Right? So when would you do either of these two? When would you overwrite the page, which is don't not worry about it, and when would you write it back to disk? Yes.
Write it back to disk, then just delete the page and then you can overwrite it if you don't need it anymore.
Okay. So if you don't need the page anymore, you will clearly overwrite. There's no reason to write it back. Absolutely right. Okay. If you need the page, then should you write it back or not? I mean, the safe thing is to always write it back. That will always work. There's no question. The issue is, should you want to do that all the time, or are there specific cases where you write it back and others when you...
Well, if it's code, it's already on disk, so you could overwrite it from disk code.
Okay, that's a good point. So if this is a code page, it's already on disk. Okay, because what did we say? An entire copy of the program is always stored on disk. Okay, so you already have those pages on disk. So here was the picture. So when you started, this were all the pages. Let's say these three pages are code pages. Okay? And when you fetch this page into RAM, or rather this page came into RAM, now it's time to evict that page. A copy of the page is already there. Okay, why write it back? Okay, the same thing, contents are already on disk. So code pages can be safely overwritten. Yeah, because you already have that on disk. Next time you need it, you just go back to that page and fetch it. There's no reason to put stuff back from RAM onto disk. Okay, so we said code pages don't need to be written back. Okay, that's good, because otherwise you would double the time to service a page for it. Because you have to write a page to disk and then read a page from disk. Okay, that's twice as much of a slowdown. Okay, so if you are evicting a code page, don't bother. Just overwrite it. It's already on disk. We don't care. So now, does that mean all data pages have to be written to disk? Code pages, we said, we don't have to write. We only fetch, because there's already... So what do we do with a data page? Yes. Right. So both code pages and data pages already reside on disk. Okay, as we just said. So the only time you have to actually write back a data page is if the data page was modified. Okay, if you actually did something, if you only read the data from this page but did not write it, then the version of the page in RAM and the version of the page in disk are identical. Okay, because you haven't modified it since you fetched it from disk. So there is no reason to put it back. Okay, it's the same page. All the bits are the same. Only if you wrote to that page, if you, let's say, you updated a variable, say x equals 1. X was formerly 0, you said x equals 1, you actually went and modified something in that page. In this case, what you have in RAM is newer, it's a new version of the page. What you have in disk is old, and that's not what you want, so you have to write back. Yes, question.
How fast is it to just check to see if you have written to it or not?
Okay, so how fast is it to check? That's the next question, right? So how do you figure this out? That's exactly right. So it's a good point. What you don't want is to go and fetch the old version of the page from disk and start comparing. That just doesn't work. Okay? So what you do is you just keep a bit in the page table. Anytime you write, you just set that bit. It's called the dirty bit. Okay, so you dirtied the page, essentially you wrote to that page. So what you do is when you try to evict a page, you just look at the page table entry. Okay? If the bit is set, then you say, I need to first write this page before I can replace it. The bit is not set, you can safely go and overwrite this page. Okay? This is the most efficient way to do this. Okay? So your TLB and page table will not only have a valid bit, it will also have a dirty bit. Okay? okay, which you will set every time you modify the page. Okay. Code pages by default will never have this bit set, because code pages to begin with are read-only pages. You don't write to code pages. Okay. Only the data pages will pass, some data pages will have this bit set. Okay. So, that's the point of what happens when a page is removed from memory. So the points are, if it's a code page, overwrite it. If it's a data page, check the valid bit. The dirty bit. If the dirty bit is not set, that means the page was not changed since you brought it from RAM, brought it from disk, overwrite it. The dirty bit is set, then you have to first write the page out to disk, okay, before you bring it back. Okay, and the part of the disk that is reserved to do all of this is called swap space. If you have played with Linux, you must have heard of swap space. Okay, swap space is the part of disk where you keep all of the process information. I'll show you an example in just a second. Okay. And the swap space, okay, so at any given time, the file, your page may be in the file system, it could be in the physical memory, and it could be in swap space. Okay, your page could be in any of these three places. Okay. So, where did this file system come from? Okay, so we know that the page could either be in RAM or it could be on swap space. That much we know. Why is the file system in the picture? Okay. This is an additional optimization. Okay, this basically says that rather than a process starts up, okay, there is no reason for you to copy the code page from your file system into your swap space. It's already on the disk. Okay, that's the program that you compile. That's the binary. Okay, so just use that as the backing store for the code segment rather than copying the code pages over to disk. Okay, so here is the picture. Just to make this clear. Okay, so this is your disk. Okay, let's make it two parts. This is swap. This is a regular file system. A regular file system has, let's say, slash bin. That's a file. Okay, this is RAM. Let's say that's a process. So an optimization that most operating systems will do is rather than when a process starts up, rather than copying this code over to the swap space, they are going to be the same pages. Just use the actual file on disk to serve as the swap for the code segment. Okay? So these will directly move into RAM as and when needed, and only the data segment, the heap segment, all of those other segments are actually stored on swap. Okay? So in other words, part of the file system is also acting as swap space for your processes. Okay. So what this means is if you have a running process and you go and modify the code for that process by, let's say, deleting it or recompiling it, that process will crash on most Unix operating systems. Okay. You can try this on Linux. I mean, you can just compile a process, run that process, and while the process is running, let's say it's an infinite loop, you go and recompile that process, you'll see that the process immediately crashes. This is because the OS was using the old version of the file. Okay, it was using it as swap, so if you go and change it, then you can no longer bring the pages it wants. Okay, the process is still executing, but the file underneath has changed. Okay. So that's important to keep in mind for some operating systems. Okay, so let me just show you a few things here. So typically, if you just on most operating systems, you do top or something like activity monitor, you will see what's happening for each of these processes. So here is, just sort this. Okay. So these are processes. That's their virtual memory in this column. This is real memory. You see that there are some processes that's up to 600 MB, 600 megabytes of virtual memory. Okay. That's Java. And there is Firefox, Safari. They take 200 MB or 168 MB. What is actually allocated is shown here. Okay. You'll see that the first process, which actually has 600 megabytes, is only allocated 75 megabytes of real RAM. Okay. Rest of it is actually stored on disk. And only that part of the process has actually been fetched into RAM. That will keep changing. as time goes by, as pages are evicted, new pages are brought in, that keeps changing. Okay. This column cannot exceed the size of RAM, the sum of this column. This column you can see is obviously much greater because there are processes that are taking as much as half a gig of RAM each. Okay, so if you add all of this up, you will say that this column adds several times more than RAM you have. Okay. But this is what is actually resident, okay, for each process. Okay. And what this thing is showing here is what has happened to RAM. Okay, so you will see that there is a pie chart here. Okay, the green is saying that's free. I mean, there's not much free space on my machine at this point. This is active. The yellow says this is memory that's in active use. The red is typically OS allocation. Okay? There's a blue which is inactive. It is potentially memory that hasn't been touched, okay, which can get evicted. Okay, we'll see how page replacement algorithms do this. These are pages that are currently being used. Okay? These are pages that are resident but are not used and are candidates for eviction. If you have to have a page fault and you fetch a new page, these are the pages you should throw out because they are not in active use. Okay. So that's basically what it's showing. So here is swaps page. You'll see there's 3 gig of swap, okay, on my machine currently configured for about 2 gig of RAM. Okay, but that could be arbitrarily large, okay, as large as you want. Yes, question.
Does the swap space ever increase like throughout the use of your computing, or does it?
Yes. So, is the swap space increased or is it static? It depends. Okay, is the right answer. There are operating systems where you can set it and then that's it. If you actually start more processes, then you have, if this summation of this column exceeds 3 gig on my machine at this point, you will actually, the OS will say it cannot start any process. It will say out of swap. Okay. But modern operating systems can dynamically choose the size of swap. So, if you run out of swap space, can automatically add more disk to swap space. Okay. If you do that, then it will just keep allocating more disk space. You will have less and less space for your files because more and more of your disk is actually being used to do virtual memory. Okay. So it depends is the short answer. If you most layers of Unix, this is actually fixed. Okay. On most modern operating systems, Macs and Windows, it's actually dynamically set. So just to show you on Linux, I can actually log in. So this, there is a partition, disk partition called swap that you actually create when you set up the or when you install your OS. Okay, so this is your swaps partition. It's typically hidden from you. It's a part of a disk. Here it's statically set. Okay, when you formatted your file system, okay, it took a part of that disk and made that swap space. So that's partition number 5 there. Okay, and you'll see that's the size. I don't know what that size is, probably a few gig. Okay. So on this machine, if you actually size of your processes exceeds that swap space, then you will not be able to create process. You can add more swap, but you have to do that manually. Okay. But on Macs and Windows, typically you don't have to do that. Your OS will manage it for you. Okay, so any other questions on paging, swap space? Yes, question.
So in this city monitor, it said you have like 200 gigs of virtual memory, but I thought that, do you really have 200 gigs of hard drive on that?
No. okay, so that's a good question. So you are asking about this thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay. This thing says potentially you can have up to 200 gig of virtual memory. Okay. The current swap I have is only this. So this says if all the processes allocated their maximum size, then this is the actual size of virtual memory you will use up. Okay. Which is, so if you have 64-bit processes, or some of them you will see are 64-bit, some of them are 32-bit. So the size of memory, there's a maximum size of RAM for each of this, RAM, address space. Okay. If all of those processes allocated their max, this is what would be used up. But not all of them are even close to their max. So this is what I actually have on disk reserved for virtual memory. Okay, so I will run out of swap space far before any process even starts using its max. Okay, because this size is actually greater than the size of my disk. Okay, but if I had a really large disk, okay, I could have created a very large swap space which allowed all of those processes to allocate as much memory as the system allows them. Okay, So it may be each process, here a process already half a gig, but you can have processes that are 100 gigs in size, for instance. Okay? But you need 100 gigs of soft space to store that single process. Okay, that's all it is saying. Okay, that this is based on the current activity, this is the max that you might need on disk. Okay, but this is all that the worst things is actually needed. It's about 3 gig. Any other questions here? Okay, so now having talked about demand paging, let's try to understand, okay, what's the performance of demand paging. Okay. So, as I already mentioned, the 90-10 rule applies. So, if your working set is always in RAM, then the frequency or the probability of a page fault will be very small. This allows the process to run at full speed. Okay? But typically, the working set will change over time. Okay? So, then you start seeing page fault that can slow down the performance. So, the question is, what kind of page fault rate can cause what kind of slowdown? Okay? So, here is a simple example which we will work through to understand this. Okay? And that the reason demand paging actually works this well is locality of reference. I already mentioned this. There are two types of locality. There's temporal locality and then there's spatial locality. Okay? Temporal locality says if I accessed page I at time t, it is very likely I'll access the same page again in the near future. Okay, so this is locality in time. Okay, so I access a page at this time, in the next few milliseconds, it's very likely I'll access this page again. Okay, that's temporal. Spatial says, if I access page I at some instant, it's very likely I may access neighboring pages in the next few instants. Not this page, but the neighboring page. Okay, that's spatial locality. Okay, because of code and whatnot. So if, let's say you're doing array access. The access ith element of an array, okay, a of I, it's very likely you might access a I of I plus 1, maybe you are in a loop and whatnot. Okay. So that's spatial. It says if you access something, some region of memory, it's likely you'll access neighboring regions of memory. Temporal says you'll access the same region again in time. Okay. Programs exhibit both kinds of locality, temporal and spatial. Okay. This is why you have a working set. This is why you have only certain regions of memory that are active at any given time. Now, question is, what kind of locality will give you what kind of performance? So, let's try to understand this. Okay, so, it says P is the probability of a page fault. Okay, just a number from 0 to 1. Okay, that dictates how frequently page faults would occur. Okay. Typically, in a demand page environment, okay, or a system, the effective memory access time, okay, E of MA, is the memory access time when you have no page fault. There are two cases to consider, and then there's a page fault. Okay. P is the probability of a page fault, and then we have okay, any memory access that causes a page fault, this is the time it will take you to service that memory reference, okay, dominated by the disk access time, which is the page fault time. If you don't have a page fault on the other hand, which is probability 1 minus P, the memory access is the same. It's E, it's MA. It's the cost of accessing RAM. Okay. So when you don't have a page fault, the memory access is the same as cost of accessing RAM. When you have a page fault, it's cost of accessing disk, overhead of accessing disk. Okay. This is an equation to keep in mind. Okay. So here's a problem. It says if memory access time is 200 nanoseconds, page fault takes 25 milliseconds. Okay. Disk access time is 25 milliseconds, RAM access time is 200 nanoseconds. And if you want effective memory access to be only 10% slower than RAM memory access, what value must P have? What kind of page fault rate can we tolerate that causes only an overall 10% slowdown? Okay, that's the problem. Okay, so before we solve this problem, think about what it's asking. It's saying, I'm willing to tolerate a 10% slowdown because of page faults overall. Okay, small slowdown. What problem? How frequently can page faults occur? If I have more page faults than that, then you will have worse than 10% slowdown. Okay, so let's try to. So, does anyone want to guess before we actually solve this? How frequently do you think page faults can occur to sustain only a 10% slowdown? What probability do you want to think? Do you think we should see when we solve this? Clearly, it should be infrequent page faults. Okay, but what should that? What do you think the probability will be before we actually work through the numbers there? Yes. Take a guess. Close to zero. How close? Really close. How many zeros do you want to add?
40.
Okay. That's a guess. Okay, any other guesses before we... I'm going to start writing this down. Okay. One more guess before I move on. Yes. 10 to the minus 6. So we'll see where we are. Okay, so that's the two range. Okay, so 10% slowdown is what kind of performance? This is regular memory access. Okay, 200 nanoseconds. On an average, you want a 10% slowdown. Okay, so what kind of average memory access are we seeing? Okay, 10% slowdown is 1.1 times 200. Okay, 200. So on an average, we want to see a memory access of 220 nanoseconds, no worse. Okay, so now we just write the equation here. So it says 220 is 1 minus p times 200. So page fault time is this, 25 milliseconds. That's 25 million nanoseconds. So this is the equation we want to solve. Alright, so do it the painful way, because I'm not going to give the solution. Okay, opened up this expression, so this becomes 20 equals to 20. Okay. So P is essentially 20 over this expression. Okay. So if you actually work that out, that turns out to be 8. That's the probability. Okay, this is basically this fraction. It's approximately equal to that. Okay. So you can see that it's a very small number. Okay, so that says that 99.99992% of the time, okay, there's no page fault. Only 0 point, this, actually I think there are two more because that's a fraction. So that's a percentage. Okay. So very, very infrequent page faults. Every several million instructions, you can only encounter one page fault, okay, for you to see only a 10% slowdown. Okay. So if you take millions of instructions, you should all execute, and every few million instructions, you want to see a page fault. Okay. Even with that frequency, you see a 10% slowdown. Okay. If you get a page fault every 100,000 instruction, your performance is going to completely tank. Okay. Because you want to see page faults every few million instruction to sort of see the program executing at near memory access speed. Okay. And most programs will actually give you this. You don't have to do anything special. Only because of this property, okay, the 90-10 rule and the locality of reference, you can actually get these kinds of numbers. Yeah, but you could easily write a program, okay, which defeats everything. You make it jump everywhere you want, you try to access memory randomly, and you'll see your performance of that program is going to be very slow. Yeah, because most programs are well behaved, okay, from a locality of reference point of view. So you get good performance. Is this clear? So this, you need to be able to do this kind of simple arithmetic. Well, there's nothing big here is just an arithmetic, but you need to understand what kind of slowdowns to encounter and so on. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the TLB quickly, and then we'll talk about page replacement. So remember that TLB is a cache for the page table. Okay, it's storing entries of the page table that have been recently accessed. Okay, so the way this works is the page table, there's a valid bit in the TLB which says if the page is in memory. There's also a dirty bit which is not mentioned here. Okay, the dirty bit tells you whether the page has been modified. Okay, if you write to the page, you flip that bit on. Okay, so any time you basically have a page TLB hit, there is no problem. The TLB entry tells you where the page is resident in RAM. Okay, if you have a TLB miss, okay, that says that this page table entry is not in the TLB. Okay, TLB miss is not the same as a page fault. TLB miss just says that this page table entry is not in the TLB. So you go to the page table in RAM, you look up that entry. Okay, and if you find the entry and the valid bit is set, you just bring it into the TLB, everything is fine. Okay, if the page table entry indicates that the page itself is not in RAM, okay, then you have a page fault. Okay, so this at this point, you'll invalidate that TLB entry. You'll perform the page table operation that we just talked about earlier. Okay, you will basically start fetching the page into RAM. Once you update the page table entry, also update the TLB entry, and then you restart the faulting process. So what this slide is saying is, in addition to doing all the page faults and updating the page tables, you also have to be mindful of the TLB itself, okay, which is a cache for the page table, and keep updating it, okay, as there are page faults or as you bring pages into memory or evict pages. Okay, so all of this is transparent. This is being done by the hardware. Okay, last point before I actually talk about page replacement is what transparency of page fault. Okay, suppose that you are executing some assembly instruction. Let's say you are doing this. Okay, and you encounter a page fault. Okay, the question is, how do you handle this page fault transparently without causing any problems? Okay, so let's try to understand what does this instruction do. Okay, it says move A R10 plus. Anyone have to guess what it does? R10 refers to register 10. It's a move instruction. It's 201. All cached out, page faults. Okay, so what this is saying is increment this register, okay, and copy the value of the register to this memory location A. Okay, so let's assume that the CPU is actually executing this instruction. It goes and it increments the register, okay, and then it tries to move that register to this memory address. Okay, that memory address causes you to look up the page table and the TLB, and let's assume that that's a page fault, okay, that the memory address, the page where this location is not in RAM. Okay, so you have a page fault, so then you suspend the execution of this process. Okay, you go fetch that page into memory. Okay, once you have fetched the page, you have to restart the execution of the process. Okay, you will re-execute the instruction. Okay, so then you will go and re-execute this instruction. Okay, so what will you do? You will increment the register, and then you will try to move that value into this memory address. Okay, this memory address is now resident in RAM, so you will move this value into the memory address. Is that good? What we just did? Okay, you incremented the register twice. Okay, okay, because you incremented it, then you try to move it here, which is exactly what the instruction tells you to do. So CPU is doing what the instruction tells it, and you had a page fault. And when you restart, you can't start from half an instruction. Okay, you execute entire instructions at a time. Okay, you can't say execute the remaining half of the instruction that I didn't execute earlier. You have to re-execute the whole thing. But then doing this causes you to increment this register twice. Okay, so what this is saying is there are many instructions, okay, which will have side effects. So re-executing that instruction causes problems. Okay, so you have to be careful that if there is a page fault, okay, before you suspend execution, you have to unwind the side effect. Okay, you have to have hardware that says undo what you did, because I am going to re-execute that instruction after the page fault has been serviced. So in this case, you will have to actually undo this increment, and then take the page fault, and then when you re-execute, you will only execute this or increment it once. Just one example of many instructions. Here is another one. There are assembly instructions that allow you to do block copies. You say basically take this chunk of RAM and move it here. It just takes an entire region of RAM and it copies it somewhere else. You do it page by page. This RAM could be of arbitrary size. So you could have the same problem here. You take the first page, you copy it somewhere. You take the second page, you copy it somewhere. And then somewhere in the middle, you have a page fault. So now you try to undo. Because we said if you have anything that you have done halfway, you undo those what you did so you can re-execute it later. Can you undo this instruction? What have we done here? You are taking this chunk of memory and you are copying it here. So you took this page and you wrote that there. You already overwrote that page. You took that page, so now if you say undo this, I don't know what was there before. So in instructions like this, you can't even start executing the instruction until you know that all of these pages that you care about are in RAM. Because you can't even undo. In the previous case, undo was simple. It's just you incremented so you can decrement and you are back to where you were. In cases like this where you are actually copy overwriting stuff and you don't know what was already in that location, you can't even undo. So you have to be very careful. You have to check that all the pages you care about for instructions where undo is not possible. You have to check that everything you care about is already resident in RAM before you even start executing. Otherwise, you will land into trouble. You will not be able to undo. So all these subtleties you have to deal with. And this depends on what instruction set your CPU supports and what the OS needs to do before it executes the instruction. So with that, we'll now talk about page replacement. This is the part where you're not fetching stuff from RAM into disk into RAM. This is the part where you're actually evicting stuff from RAM into put it back to disk. So question is, you have a page fault. You're bringing a new page from disk. And assume that RAM is completely filled up. You have no free space, no free frames. So the only way to fetch this page is to throw some other page out. Question is, which page will you pick to throw? So there are several policies. First one says random. Random says tell the OS pick a page, toss a coin, pick a page, evict that page. And evict basically means if it's not been modified, if the dirty bit is not set, just gets overwritten. The dirty bit is set, you will actually first write it out and then override the page. So random policy is trivial. It says that of all the pages, you pick some page at random and we'll evict that page and everything is good. And here are some others. FIFO basically says first in, first out. You keep a queue of pages for the process. When a new page comes in, throw the page that was brought in first, because it's a FIFO queue. So as you add pages to the queue, tail of the queue, and you evict pages from the head of the queue. A simple policy. Throw the page that was brought in, or essentially the oldest page. You're throwing out the oldest page. Simple policy may not necessarily be good, as we will see. There are two other policies we'll talk about. One is called min. Min says look into the future and throw the page that is going to be accessed the farthest into the future. We'll also see that this is actually an optimal policy. LRU, or the least recently used, that's the term LRU, says that basically throw out the least recently used page. Look at recency of access and throw out the page that was least recently accessed. So we'll actually study these three policies. So now try to first understand the difference between LRU and FIFO. FIFO says throw out the oldest page. LRU says throw out the least recently accessed page. What's the difference between the two? Yes. Yes. So OLS just says, look at when it was brought in from disk, okay, and throw the one that was brought in first among all the pages that exist. Recently accesses, look at when the pages are actually used, not when you brought it, but when were they last used, and throw the one that hasn't been used in a while, not the one that you fetched first. The one that you fetched first may still be getting used, you may be accessing it heavily. Throw the one that least used rather than the one that you brought in first. Okay? So this should clearly tell you that this LRU policy is looking at locality of reference. It's saying look at what the process is not using and throw that out first, not the page that you brought in first, because it may still be using it. Okay? So this one doesn't look at what the process is actually doing. It only looks at when you brought in pages and you evict the page that's oldest. This one says look at the access pattern. Okay? Now this policy, which is called min or opt, is saying that look into the future. Right? See, look at the page that is now is going to be accessed farthest into the future. Of all the pages I have, see when each page is going to get accessed from this point on, the page that is not going to be accessed for the longest time from the current time is the one that you should evict. Okay, so LRU is looking at the past, saying look at what has already happened and throw the one that is least accessed. Min is looking at the future and says which of these pages will you access last, looking further out, and then throw the one off. Okay, so now, on the one hand, this policy is optimal. Okay, we'll try to understand why. But on the other hand, this is a policy that has a problem. What's the problem? Yes. Yes, you don't know what's going to happen in the future without running the program. Your operating system is not an oracle. Okay, it's not, doesn't have a crystal ball that it can actually look at and say this is what is going to happen. But if it knew that, okay, you can show that this policy is optimal. Okay, so let's try to understand, assume that you knew, okay, that exactly what the process is going to do. Why is this the right thing to do? Yes. Yes, exactly right. So this policy, as you will see, will actually be the policy that incurs the least page fault. So the, what we really want from these policies is to reduce the page fault rate as much as possible. Okay? If you throw out the page that's going to get accessed farthest into the future, it's guaranteed that you will not, that you are delaying the page fault until that page is accessed. Okay? If you throw out any other page, then you are going to, your program is going to execute, and you'll, when you hit that page, you will have a page fault. So by delaying page faults as much as possible, the policy gives you optimal results, saying this is the right page to evict of all the pages, because it postpones the page fault farthest into the future, because the page fault is going to occur when this page that you evicted is actually going to get access next. Okay, so by reducing the page fault rate in this fashion, you can get optimal results. Okay. The flip side of this is you cannot never implement this policy in practice, okay, because you don't know what the future looks like. LRU is an approximation of this policy. LRU you can implement, but it's an approximation. Okay? The approximation says that the recent past is always a good predictor of the near future. Okay? Because of locality of reference, okay, if you actually observe what the program has been doing, if it actually exhibits spatial and temporal locality, you know this is how the process is going to behave in the near future. Okay. So look at the past access pattern. If there are pages that haven't been accessed recently, it's likely they will not be accessed in the near future. Okay. If there are pages that are actively used in the near past, because of locality of reference, the program is likely to continue to access those pages. Okay. So if you just look at the past and evict the page that was least recently used, this approximates, not exact, but it's an approximation of pages that are not likely to be the used for the longest time. Okay. So LRU is an approximation that will actually do that, okay, but it's not exact. I'm going to do one exercise here and then we'll stop. Okay. So here is an example of how such a policy might work. Okay. So we'll start with FIFO. Okay. We'll assume that you have three pages or three frames in RAM. Okay. RAM has size of 3, okay, and you have processor size of 4. Okay. There are pages A, B, C, D. Okay. This is called the reference stream of the process. A reference stream says that's the order in which pages are actually accessed by instructions or data. Okay? Page A is accessed first and then B and C and then again A, B, D and so on. Okay? And the question is, if you had a FIFO policy, what is the contents of RAM going to look like? Okay? And how many page faults are you going to see? Okay, so we'll do this one exercise and then we'll continue with other policies next time. Okay, so quick exercise here. Okay, first access is to A. Okay, so that's A here. Okay, that's a page fault because RAM is empty at this point. Okay, so F1, F2. Okay, so that's a page fault. Okay, next access is B. Okay, so A still remains here. So you'll have to, that's a page fault also. We'll fetch B in from disk, we'll put it, there's an empty frame here, so there's nothing to replace yet. So we'll put it in frame 2. Okay, next access is C. And it's also a page fault. Okay, so you'll now bring C into memory. Okay, there's an empty frame, so you put it there. It's a page fault. Okay, next access is what? A. So A is already resident in RAM, so nothing to do. Okay, so the memory content don't change, stays exactly as is. Next access is B. Okay, so also in RAM, so nothing happens. Contents of memory doesn't change. Then you access D. Okay, D is not resident in RAM, that's a page fault. And now you have to evict a page because you don't have any free frames. Okay, so what would FIFO do? It's going to throw out A because that's the page that was fetched first amongst A, B and C. Okay, so A goes out, D comes in. That's the, that's what RAM looks like at that point. And then you access A again. Okay, you just threw out A, it's too bad. So you have another page fault. Okay, so of D, B and C, what's the oldest page? It's B. Okay, because C was fetched after D, so you'll basically evict B. Okay, so we are now at A here, then you access D. Okay, that's not a problem here. Okay, and you access B, which is not in RAM. Okay, so you will basically fetch that again. Evict C. Okay, so now you evicted C. So then you access C again, you just threw it out. That's another page fault. Okay. Which of this is the oldest page? It's D. So you will throw that out. So you have C, A, B. That's another page fault. Then you access B. It's already resident. You are done. Okay. So some of those accesses cause page faults and some don't. Whenever you have a page fault, you have to look at the policy and throw out the page that's dictated by the policy. Okay. So this will result in 7 page faults. Okay. So we'll look at other tech, there are several exercises here, we'll look at those next time. Okay, but before you all go, I just want to say something about the lab assignment. Okay, so here is the, okay, so lab 3 I just put out there. Okay, so basic, so this is the next lab. Okay, you have 2 weeks to finish this. Relatively simple assignment. Okay. All you have to do is simulate, okay, not actually do, simulate a memory manager that does contiguous memory allocation. Okay. So what you will do is you will basically write a memory manager that starts with some amount of RAM. Okay. You will be given a trace of request saying allocate for this process so much memory. Okay. So you will chop that RAM up into smaller chunks and keep allocating. Keep track of what is available, what is not. Okay. And then basically every time you free something, you will have to do free block coalescing. I'll talk about that in just a moment. Okay, so let me just show you. This will be discussed in more detail tomorrow. Okay, I just want to mention this today. Okay. So this is the class. So it has several things. There's an allocate function which says these many bytes to this process is what you need to allocate. There's a deallocate method which says just deallocate all of the RAM allocated to this process, and there's a print memory state method which says at this point just print out the state of memory, what chunks are allocated, what chunks are not. Okay. You are supposed to implement both best fit and first fit. Okay, so it will say that both best fit and first fit need to be implemented. So anytime you get a request for allocation, you need to search through your free block list. Okay, these are the list of all the holes saying where are you going to put this process. Okay, and then you allocate that chunk to that process. Okay, so here is what the potential trace might look like. Okay, so as it says, the first line of this file has the memory size and the policy. Okay, one stands for best fit and two stands for first fit. So this says 8K of RAM, okay, and you use first fit, and then this is the trace. It says allocate 232 bytes to process 1, then it allocates 458 bytes to process 2, then allocate 30 bytes to process 3. It says deallocate, memory allocated to 1. So you have to actually, for each of these lines, you have to then go and do what it asks you to do to your simulated RAM. Okay? At any point you might have this P command which says, okay, at this point just dump what the state of RAM looks like. You will have to say there are 10 holes and there are 3 processes active. These are the regions that you allocated to these processes. These are the regions that are allocated to the holes. Okay? So there are several longer traces in these files here. Okay, we will run them with other traces as well, so you need to ensure correctness for your program. Okay. That's the first part. Okay, do first fit and best fit. Okay. As part of that, you need to do what is called free block coalescing. Free block coalescing essentially says, very quickly, let's say this is RAM, this is allocated processes. Okay, anything that's shaded is allocated, anything that is blank is free. So if this process gets deallocated, you will now have 3 holes that are all adjacent. This says you have to merge these holes. Okay, there's no reason to keep these 3 holes because there's really one large chunk of memory. Okay, so basically it says whenever you deallocate a process, see if the adjacent memory region, the region above it and region below it are holes. If so, merge them all and make a bigger hole. Okay, that's all free block coalescing says. Okay. So you have to do that as part of first fit and best fit. That's the first part of the assignment. Okay. Second part of the assignment says now we will add compaction. Okay. Because in some of these traces, as you will see, if it did not do compaction because of external fragmentation, you will actually have to say, I cannot allocate this request because I don't have a hole that's large enough. Okay. So some of those requests will fail. Okay. So in the second part, you have to do compaction, which is move memory around to reconstruct large holes so you can actually allocate a chunk to a process. Okay. So those are the two parts that you need to allocate. So all simulation, you are not actually allocating any RAM. Okay. Don't do anything new. You just have to keep data structure that simulate what that sequence of process arrivals and departure does to this RAM. Okay. So tomorrow there will be a more detailed discussion, but I would urge you to at least read this assignment and come to the discussion section with class. Yes. Test grades in a few days. We are not completely done.